Good morning. A new NPR PBS News Marist poll shows in the run-up to the shutdown more Republicans were being blamed. As the shutdown gets underway, we'll run down what government services will keep operating on Morning Edition from NPR News. We'll also speak with the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee as her party pushes for extending health care subsidies now rather than wait. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Can the strategy to shut down the government backfire? Also, we now know what the president and his defense secretary wanted to tell all of the country's military commanders. The military is not tough enough. We'll get a response from a Marine veteran who served in Vietnam and Iraq. It's Wednesday, October 1st. 50 years ago today, Muhammad Ali beat Joe Frazier in the Thriller in Manila. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Congress is pointing fingers this morning as a government shutdown takes effect. Senate leaders from both parties are blaming each other for the stalemate that brought the federal government to a standstill overnight. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Republicans failed to deliver.
There are going to be millions of American families in the next week in October sitting down and saying, how are we going to pay these damn bills?
Senate Majority Leader John Thune is placing the blame on Democrats.
The Democrat caucus here in town in the Senate has chosen to shut down the government over a clean, nonpartisan funding bill.
Essential government services like Social Security checks and VA benefits will continue, and air traffic controllers will remain on the job. But museums and many federal offices are now closed. Republicans control both chambers of Congress, but need Democratic support in the Senate to approve any government funding deal. The White House has threatened mass layoffs of federal employees in addition to furloughs during the shutdown. NPR's Andrea Shue reports federal employee unions are now suing the Trump administration.
The lawsuit stems from a memo that the White House Office of Management and Budget sent to federal agencies last week. It told agencies to consider sending layoff notices to federal employees working on programs or activities that aren't consistent with the president's priorities in the event of a government shutdown. The two unions behind the lawsuit together represent more than 800,000 federal employees. They argue that the threat of layoffs is, quote, an unlawful abuse of power designed to punish workers and pressure Congress. They've asked a federal court in San Francisco to find that the Office of Management and Budget unlawfully exceeded its authority in issuing the memo and to invalidate actions that come from it. Andrea Shue, NPR News.
The White House is launching a website for prescription drugs called Trump RX. NPR's Cindy Lupkin reports the site would facilitate sales directly to consumers at a discount.
President Trump announced a deal with Pfizer to sell its drugs directly to consumers. The medicines will be available through a website operated by the federal government called Trump RX.
The United States is done subsidizing the health care of the rest of the world. It's a big thing. I can't tell you how big this is.
The announcement came as part of the president's push to get lower drug prices for Americans. He aims to bring them in line with what other developed countries pay. The deal also includes discounts for Medicaid and a pledge from Pfizer to sell new drugs at the same price in the U.S. and other developed countries. Trump says similar deals with other drug makers are in the works. Cindy Lupkin, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. Starting today, Amazon is officially retiring its Prime Invitee program. Users will no longer be allowed to share free shipping benefits to people who don't live in their household. The replacement is Amazon Family, which only allows benefit sharing among people who share the same address. The change is part of the company's push to reduce benefit leakage and enforce stricter membership rules. Hollywood is pushing back against the arrival of an AI-generated avatar whose creators are calling, quote, the next Scarlett Johansson. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports Tilly Norwood has so far only appeared in short social media clips.
It's also unclear whether Tilly Norwood, a fair-skinned brunette with a Margot Robbie smile, can perform scenes with other actors, since the AI has so far only made solo appearances on social media.
Three seasons.
Nevertheless, its presence has riled up the acting community since the company that made Tilly Norwood, Particle 6, announced this past weekend the creation of a new AI talent studio. Here's Oscar winner Ariana DeBose.
Computer programs don't have emotions. They don't have life experiences to draw on. So simply put, this is one area where computers cannot replace people.
The actors' union SAG-AFTRA has issued a statement condemning the AI, but some actors don't seem fazed. Bring it on, said Whoopi Goldberg in a segment on ABC's The View. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
On Wall Street, Dow futures are trading lower at this hour. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
Early 2019, Cao Kalia Yang had only been to one opera in her life, and she'd fallen asleep. But here she was, staring at an email from the Minnesota Opera. The nearly 60-year-old institution wanted to adapt her book, The Song Poet, for the stage. An opera. Why not? Yang had written the book about her father, a child during the Vietnam War, who'd had to flee his home in Laos with the family rooster tucked under his arm. After living in a Thai refugee camp, her father was finally able to make a home in St. Paul, Minnesota. The Minnesota Opera gave Yang another surprise when it asked her to be the librettist, the person who writes the text for the opera. Well, that was something she'd never done before, but okay. And it actually gave her an opportunity to rethink the story, to rearrange scenes and add new ones. When The Song Poet premiered at the Minnesota Opera in March 2023, tickets had already been sold out for 6 months for the first Hmong story ever told through opera.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The federal government is shut down after Republicans and Democrats in the Senate could not agree on a funding bill. A new NPR PBS News Marist poll is out this morning, and it found that most people, or more people, would blame Republicans for a shutdown. In a few minutes, we're going to speak with Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro about her party strategy.
First, though, more details from that poll. It found the overwhelming majority believe children should be vaccinated before they're going to school, and that it's more important to control gun violence rather than protect gun rights.
NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro has all the numbers. So, Domenico, let's start with the shutdown. What did the poll find?
Yeah, Republicans get more of the blame, 38 to 27, though. That's not close to a majority. In 2019, during what was the longest government shutdown in history, over a month, 50% or more blamed Trump. Now, 31% would blame both parties equally. Trump and Republicans get low approval ratings, but Democrats in Congress are worse. Just 25% approve of them. That's because of Democrats, by the way. Less than half approve of members of their own party in Congress. So a lot of politics to play here as the shutdown goes on.
Now, one thing that really jumps out in this survey, which you've written about this morning on NPR.org, the idea that more people believe they might have to resort to violence to fix things. I mean, how many people are we talking about?
Yeah, the number is up to 30% who think that they may have to resort to violence to get the country back on the right track. That's up 11 points from when we asked that question in April of last year.
So what do you think is driving that?
Largely, it's changed views among some Democrats. I mean, they've gone from just 12% saying violence might be necessary to now 28%. That's a pretty big jump. But Republicans are higher still at 31%. That's also a marginal increase from last year. And even a quarter of independents are saying this saying this now. You know, it's important to remember, though, 70% of people do not feel this way. More than three quarters say political violence is a major problem. And other polling has shown that when specific acts of violence are polled, the numbers are much lower. Still, it's pretty alarming, though, that people are increasingly feeling this way.
Yeah. Now, okay, let's get to free speech, something we've been talking about a lot since Jimmy Kimmel was taken off the air for a week after the Trump administration pressured ABC and its affiliates. So how are people feeling about free speech in America?
Well, they're not feeling like it's very free. Roughly 8 in 10 say they think that the country's gone too far in restricting speech. That crosses political lines, with almost 9 in 10 Democrats and independents saying this, as well as almost two-thirds of Republicans. Remember, conservatives were the ones who were saying for years that they felt that their speech, their free speech rights, were being curtailed on college campuses and online. So a lot of people now have gripes with what can and can't be said in the country, and that's showing up in this poll. People also believe the federal government should play a minimal role in regulating speech. Just 15% said they think it should be a major role. It should have a major role in doing so. 44% said it should play only a minor one. Another 4 in 10 said it should play no role at all.
All right, now to the National Guard being deployed to cities and what President Trump says is a plan to reduce crime and assist law enforcement. Trump says he's been focusing on places such as Memphis, Portland, Oregon, and also Chicago. How are people feeling about whether they want them in their city?
Yes, the majority, 52%, support the effort, but mostly because of how strongly Republicans feel about it. 90% of Republicans are in favor, compared to majorities of Democrats and independents who are opposed. For Democrats, three-quarters are opposed to it, 60% strongly so. Makes for a really polarizing issue.
And one more really quick, the Epstein files. How do people feel about that?
More than 6 in 10 disapprove of Trump's handling of the files related to the late financier who died in prison by suicide 5 years ago. Three-quarters want them fully released with victims' names redacted.
NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, thanks.
You got it.
Democrats objected yesterday when the House convened for less than 5 minutes, long enough to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, and then adjourned without taking up any business.
Pursuant to Clause 13 of Rule 1, the House stands adjourned until 3:30 p.m. on Friday, October 3rd at 2025.
One of the lawmakers on the Democratic side of the House was Representative Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut. She's the ranking member on the House Appropriations Committee. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. It's lovely to be with you today.
So you were in the House yesterday asking to be recognized, and you weren't. Mm-hmm. What did you want to say?
Well, what I wanted to do was have the opportunity. But when I was, it was rejected. Your clip is right. They gaveled me down. What I wanted to do was to offer a bill. This was the a continuing resolution alternative that Senator Patty Murray and myself offered that would stop the government shutdown. It would keep the government funded through October 31st, avoid the shutdown, allow for bipartisan negotiations to continue over full year spending bills. And that way, it would ensure that Congress, not the president or Russ Vought, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, will determine how taxpayer dollars are spent.
Now, Republicans are blaming Democrats for the shutdown. Democrats are blaming Republicans. We just heard the results of a new NPR PBS News Marist poll that said just 1 in 4 people approve of how Democrats in Congress are doing. And that's not great for your party. Is this shutdown a bid to improve your standing with voters?
You know, let's put polling aside. I listened to the polling data and know something about polls. 38%, 27% say that, Republicans will be to blame. Let's just take, what is the fact of the matter here. Republicans chose, they chose to shut down the government rather than get into a bipartisan negotiation with Democrats. I have chaired the Appropriations Committee. I'm the ranking member. I have negotiated appropriations bills with Senator Shelby in Alabama, with Congresswoman Granger, with Congressman Cole, with Senators Murray and Collins, Senator Leahy. We have done it. It was a bipartisan negotiation. So now, what is at the center of this? What is at the center of this fight? It is over the health care crisis that has been caused by the Republicans. 20 million Americans are going to see their health care costs skyrocket. 15 million people are going to be jettisoned from Medicaid. They're going to decimate Medicaid. This is historic. This has not happened in U.S. history. In addition, your hospitals were shut down, nursing homes shut down.
Can I ask you a question on that? I mean, Senate Republican Leader John Thune said he's open to talking about extending the Obamacare subsidies. He's open to negotiation. He doesn't want it to be tied to stopgap spending bill.
I'm going to answer your question because that sounds wonderful, and if you really have been engaged and involved with what's gone on in the last really couple of years here with deals, if you will, made with Republican leadership, all of that has been abrogated. All of it abrogated. Quite frankly, there is no trust factor. We have watched during this period of time, first Elon Musk, in January, President Trump illegally fires 17 inspectors generally. January 27th, they illegally freeze vast swaths of financial assistance. Musk and Trump look at dismantling government. There's a whole litany of what they have done. And, you know, I tell you, if you trust what they say they're going to do, I've got a bridge that I'm going to sell you. I mean that. It is really impossible. In the midst of these negotiations, Russ Vogt, who is the mastermind of this effort, and who wants a shutdown, and he said, his words are very clear, there should be less bipartisanship. The President of the United States said it's a waste of time to negotiate with Jeffries and Schumer. And the Republicans rally around, jam this Republican continuing revolution down the Democrats' throat. Now, you tell me if that acts in good faith, and Mr. Vogt introduced a bill that would continue to steal the money appropriated by Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate.
This shutdown
as we're into these negotiations.
This shutdown is a reality now, right? I mean, it's impacting Americans right now.
Yes, and that's...
Democrats said they were worried back in March that a shutdown would hand the president more power over the federal workforce. Yeah. The president is now threatening mass layoffs. What's changed that worry is no longer here?
Well, the president, I mean, this threat of mass layoffs is really so disingenuous because we have been dealing with mass layoffs, you know, for the last several months. You've got 17,000 people gone from the Department of Health and Human Services, 12,000 people gone from the Veterans Administration. It's rampant that what they have been doing, just on whim, with no discussion. And let me just say this. We had discussed in appropriations coming to a bipartisan discussion, which is the case on a bipartisan discussion, which we can do. And it's about the healthcare crisis. And the issue is healthcare is one of the things that drives the cost up for people every single day, that their cost of living. What we need to do is to make sure that the cuts are no longer there, that we address the cost of living, and we save healthcare for the American people. That is what's on the line. That's what Democrats are prepared to do.
Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Today is the first day in our entire history at NPR that we are fulfilling our public mission without federal funding, and we are still here. With your support, my co-hosts and I will be here every morning, and our journalists around this country and the world will keep you informed. We're not going anywhere because we're powered by you, the public, and we're accountable to you, the public. This is NPR News.
Queens.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead, urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it, because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters Friday. And from RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors work to understand individual goals and are dedicated to providing customized advice to help strengthen financial security. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. President Trump told his top military commanders that the U.S. military would be used against what he calls the enemy within, pointing to Democratic-run cities that he has long said have high crime rates.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth also spoke at the unusual gathering in Quantico, Virginia, and he reiterated to the generals that the purpose of the department would exclusively be, quote, warfighting.
Joining us now to talk about all this is NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, before we get to the president, what stood out to you about Hegseth's remarks?
Well, you know, what he said about toughening physical fitness standards for those in combat jobs. So we're talking armor, artillery, and infantry. You know, he said he wants both men and women to achieve, quote, the highest male standard in such things as lifting weights, carrying an ammo box, running. So there were some 600 female Marines in those jobs in the Army, 3,000 or 4,000 women. Women in combat positions, and I'm told you could lose more than 20% of those women in those jobs if they have to meet the highest male standard. Now, Hegseth said that wasn't the goal. Let's listen.
If women can make it, excellent. If not, it is what it is. If that means no women qualify for some combat jobs, so be it. That is not the intent, but it could be the result. So be it.
Hegseth also said it may mean weak men don't qualify.
All right. So Hegseth has long criticized what he calls the Pentagon's woke culture. What did he have to say about it yesterday?
Right. He said the Pentagon was the Department of Woke, and now it's the Department of War. He said he's ending the war on warriors and saying that some were promoted for their race or gender. Of course, he fired the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General C.Q. Brown, the second African-American to hold that job, indicating that he got the job not on merit, even though Brown was a key figure in the defeat of the Islamic State. You know, Hegseth also thinks overall the military has not been tough enough. Too many lawyers second-guessing troops on rules of engagement in war or bullying or hazing of troops. He also wants drill sergeants to be much more tough on recruits.
You know, the president has defended the use of U.S. troops in American cities. He specifically mentioned Democratic-led cities such as Chicago, describing it as overrun with crime. NPR reporting, though, shows that crime is falling there and also in many other cities. So what exactly did he say about the use of the military domestically?
Well, Trump said the U.S. should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, saying mostly Democrat-run cities have crime rates. As you mentioned, the crime rates have been dropping. Now, Trump's comments were denounced by Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, a top Democrat in armed services and an Army veteran. He called it dangerous. He said treating our own communities as war zones and our own citizens as enemies.
Tom, you've spent some two decades embedding with U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's your reaction to Trump and Hegseth talking about a, quote, woke military?
Well, it's kind of a caricature. People I spend time with in combat zones, they say we've always had a warrior ethos. And it's important to note, that women have received medals for valor, and more than 150 women passed the grueling Army Ranger course at the same standards as men. Hegseth has neither a valor medal nor a Ranger tab.
All right, that's NPR's Tom Bowman. Tom, as always, thanks.
You're welcome.
We've also brought in Colonel Mark Cansey in to talk about these speeches. He's a Marine veteran with three decades of experience, including tours in Vietnam, Iraq, and Operation Desert Storm. He's now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Colonel, so what were you worried about what this meeting might be, and what did you think about what it turned out to be?
Well, going into this meeting, there was really no agenda and lots of speculation about whether this would be a purge of the generals, whether it would be a bloodletting, whether there would be demand for an oath of loyalty, whether there would be demands that senior officers endorse the Trump administration's partisan policies. None of that happened. That was a great relief. It was quite straightforward. The military weren't put in a position where they were forced to do things that seemed to imply political endorsements. They had clearly been briefed before they went in, not to cheer, not to applaud in the middle of speeches, but to hold that all to the end, standing ovation. And that's pretty standard for military audiences.
Okay.
But it wasn't what President Trump was expecting. He thought this was going to be some sort of campaign rally.
Now, and so what it turned out to be, though, what did you think of that? I think we're having trouble with Colonel Mark Cansian. Let's see if we can try and figure out a way to get him back at some point. But Colonel was going to talk to us about what the meeting turned out to be and some of the standards that are now going to be in effect in the military going forward with Secretary of Defense Hegseth and some of the things he outlined on that day. You know, today is the first day in our entire history here at NPR that we do not have public funding. We do not have federal funding. We are still here, though. We will always remain here because of listeners and supporters like you. I'll never forget the day I first heard about public radio. It wasn't that long ago. It was only about 15 years ago, and it really changed my life. So, you know, for people that are like me that need their lives changed and need to be exposed to this, we're going to rely on you going forward to support us and to always know that we will be here for you no matter what. This is NPR News.
Tom Johnson was a top White House aide to LBJ, also a major newspaper publisher, and eventually the president of CNN. But despite his success, he spent many years suffering from depression in silence.
You can talk about a broken arm or a broken leg, but talking about a broken mind, it's tough to do.
I'm Elsa Chang. How mental health advocacy is becoming another part of Tom Johnson's legacy on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show here on member-supported radio KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. The KAXE KBXE Book Club is reading How to Solve Your Own Murder by Kristen Perrin for October Meetings are at 5:30 Wednesday, October 8th at KAXE in Grand Rapids, and Tuesday, October 21st at KBXE in Bemidji. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month, beginning October 1st from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, along with the Cass and Crow Wing Soil and Water Conservation Districts, host a Smart Salting for Roads certification course Wednesday, October 8th from 8 to 1:30 in Bacchus. Learn how to maintain safe roads while reducing environmental impacts. Free with registration, required by October 1st. Text KAXE for more information at 218-326-1234. And After Dark is KAXE's Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at kaxe.org. Itasca County Public Health offers a flu vaccine clinic Thursday, October 2nd from 4 to 6 at the Itasca Resource Center in Grand Rapids for those with and without insurance. No appointments are necessary. And Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series tomorrow at noon. This month, hydrologist Sarah Elliott will talk about the ecological implications of forest fires on our water. Register at itascawaters.org. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, October 1st, 2007, I took an inventory of flowers that I was still finding in bloom. Among them, red clover, tansy, goldenrod, yarrow, common sow thistle, black-eyed Susans, white clover, and Canada thistle. Every year, in mid-September and on through at least October, perhaps mid-November, I try to do an inventory of the flowers that are still in bloom. And comparing those over the years, I find that it's often the same group. Red clover, of course, is that clover-like flower. It's a bright red color and is pretty easy to find. Tansy is one of those invasive species, and it seems like there one or two of those tansy blossoms will hold on forever. Goldenrod typically is done blooming before the 1st of October, but in this year I was able to find one. Yarrow, another one of those plants that can keep on blooming. Sow thistle, that was a bit of a surprise. Black-eyed Susans, they tend to peak in August, but boy, they are oftentimes among the last flowers that we're likely to see in the fall.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Odoo, maker of business management software with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C., where Republicans and Democrats could not agree on a plan to fund the government.
Democrats have pushed to include extensions of health care subsidies in the spending bill. Republicans say they're open to negotiations only after a bill is passed.
What does the shutdown mean for the more than 2 million civilian federal workers in the country?
For more, we're joined by NPR's Andrea Hsu. So first off, what does the shutdown mean for the services people get from the government?
Yeah, well, even during a shutdown, some things do carry on. For example, your mail will still be delivered. Retirees will still get their Social Security checks. And if you go to the airport, you'll still see the TSA officers at the security checkpoints. And the Trump administration has made clear Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers will remain on the job. But many, many more federal employees will not be working A. Typically, people are given up to half a day to close down their computers and do whatever else needs to be done for an orderly shutdown.
And they're not getting paid.
That's right. And even most essential workers who are working won't be paid during the shutdown. This became a problem last time in late 2018, early 2019, when the government was shut down for those 35 days. After a while, you had TSA officers calling out sick because, you know, A, some people just can't go that long without a paycheck. Now, Congress did pass a law in 2019 mandating that federal employees get back pay once a shutdown is over. But this time, as you said, there have been threats from the White House that many federal workers could be outright fired during this shutdown.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, last week, the White House Office of Management and Budget told federal agencies they should consider issuing reduction in force or RIF notices to employees who are working on things that aren't consistent with the president's priorities, meaning they would not be brought back when the government reopens. But even if some agencies opt to do this, it doesn't mean people are going to be fired today or tomorrow necessarily. There are really complicated procedures for conducting RIFs. Federal statute requires that the government workers be given 60 days notice, for one thing. The White House has said that the staff handling RIFs are allowed to work through the shutdown, so it's possible we could see some notices go out.
Now, what are you hearing from federal employees about, you know, possibly being fired and then not brought back to work?
Yeah, well, yesterday, unions representing federal employees filed a lawsuit over this. They called the threats of mass layoffs during the shutdown an unlawful abuse of power by the Trump administration. They said it was aimed at punishing workers and pressuring Democrats in Congress to essentially cave. Now, the White House did not respond to our request for comment about this lawsuit. Meanwhile, you have some federal employees saying this threat of being laid off at any moment, that this is nothing new. Jenna Norton, a scientist with the National Institutes of Health, talked about this at a press conference on Monday. She was among several feds who spoke in their personal capacity, and here's what she said.
As a federal worker, I am here to tell you that every awful thing that would happen in a shutdown, shuttering programs that Americans rely on, damaging our economy, firing federal workers, all of this is already happening.
And A, there have been numerous lawsuits challenging all those things, firings, dismantling of programs and whole agencies. And while lower courts have temporarily paused many of those actions, the Supreme Court has in multiple instances allowed the Trump administration to move forward, at least for now.
How will we know if there are indeed mass firings?
Well, I suspect we'd hear from employees themselves, but also federal agencies are required to notify labor unions and states ahead of mass layoffs. The Trump administration has not always followed these rules, but they might do so this time.
That's NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thanks a lot, Andrea.
You're welcome.
One of the unions that has filed a lawsuit challenging any layoffs amid the shutdown is the American Federation of Government Employees. It represents over 800,000 federal workers, including TSA agents, Social Security professionals, park rangers, and many more. Joining us now to talk about how these workers and you will be impacted by this shutdown is AFGE President Everett Kelly. Everett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Leela, for having me.
So what's the argument your union is making in its lawsuit challenging these layoff threats?
Okay. Well, Leela, first of all, thank you for having me.
But, thank you for being here.
Yeah. As you know, AFGE and AFSCME filed a lawsuit yesterday challenging the administration's threat to fire large amounts of federal employees if the government shuts down, because we don't believe that he has the authority to do that. You know, that plan had nothing to do with an illegal, you know, it's an illegal abuse of power designed to punish patriotic civil servants and, you know, put pressure on Congress. And we're asking a judge to put a halt, you know, to any mass firing during a government shutdown. You know, go ahead.
Yes, we heard the president threaten to do these mass firings, saying he'll cut things that the Democrats like. Which workforce do you believe will be most affected by this shutdown now that it's started?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be evenly distributed across the board. And then, two, you know, it's so hard to say with this administration, you know, they're calling this a shutdown, but in actuality, this is a employee lockout. These employees are being locked out of their job. They want to go to work, you know, but they are told that they can't go to work, you know, and, you know, they may use a pretty word, but it's still a lockout. Mm-hmm. So, but it's going to affect, you know, it could affect a number of employees in any agency. That's the thing about it. At this point, they've not even given us an implementation plan. Prior to this, you know, we would at least have some implementation plan. There would be some discussions, you know, and it's been nothing. It's been crickets.
Oh, really? So what does that mean for implementing the shutdown?
Got nothing.
What does this mean for Americans? How will the American public feel the shutdown around services and things like that?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, Americans are going to begin to feel, you know, lags in their benefits. You know, there could be delays in filing beneficiary claims. There could be delays in receiving their beneficiaries payments. It could be, you know, long lines at the airports. I mean, any number of things, you know, veterans coming to receive services could be affected by that. You know, it's a lot of things that is going to occur because of these actions, you know. So I'm encouraging, you know, the Congress to do their job, to figure out, get in the room, shut the door, figure out a way to get the American people what they deserve, and that is put the federal workforce back to work so they can provide the services for the American people.
Are there any safety nets in place for services that are deemed absolutely necessary?
Well, you know, the thing is, eventually, you know, these employees will get paid, the federal employees, eventually. You know, but, you know, 65% already work from paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, anytime that they're missing a paycheck could be detrimental to those employees.
Ever Kelly is the president for the American Federation of Government Employees. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingel. Thanks to our listeners, you have helped us raise over $170,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate or share our work. Visit KAXE.org. Learn about chronic wasting disease with the Minnesota chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Thursday, October 2nd from 5 to 8 at Cuyuna Brewing Company in Crosby. Find out how to prepare your deer for testing and share hunting stories and wild game recipes with other hunters. The Reif Gallery in Grand Rapids has a reception for the exhibit In Plain Air, a group show from local outdoor painters, Friday, October 3rd from 4 to 5:30. United Way of Bemidji is collecting coats and other winter gear now until October 7th at Dress Club Cleaners and both Lukens Village food locations. Items may be new or gently used. Distribution will take place Saturday, October 11th from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church in Bemidji. The McCroskey Arts Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the new exhibit, Unearthed, Friday, October 3rd from 4 to 7. It's a two-person mixed media show developed from foraged objects. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KAXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KAXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. A federal judge in Boston has ruled that the Trump administration is violating the Constitution by trying to deport non-U.S. citizens just because they've protested in support of Palestinians or criticized Israel. U.S. District Court Judge William Young on Tuesday called it possibly the most important case ever to reach the federal court he serves on. NPR's Adrian Florido has been covering this. What did the judge have to say in his ruling?
Well, Judge Young called the Trump administration's attempts to deport non-citizens because of their Palestinian activism unconstitutional violations of their rights to free speech. He wrote that it's carrying out a full-throated assault on the First Amendment. The evidence A presented during a 9-day trial that the judge held in July, he wrote, clearly showed that Homeland Security and State Department officials have been misusing their powers to silence protesters' protected political speech. And he wrote that he was especially disturbed by the methods immigration agents have been using to arrest people, especially their use of face masks, which the judge wrote seemed intended to, quote, terrorize Americans into quiescence.
You know, a lot of these pro-Palestinian students that ICE agents started arresting and trying to deport soon after Trump took office have their own cases going against the government. So who brought this particular case and why?
Well, this case was brought by several academic associations, and their goal was to convince the judge that the government has what they call an ideological deportation policy aimed at silencing the specific pro-Palestinian academics that were being arrested, but also aimed at scaring others into not speaking up about Palestinian rights. They called government officials to the stand during the trial to prove this, and DHS officials testified that they compiled the names of thousands of pro-Palestinian activists starting early this year and created dossiers on many of them. They sent those files to officials at the State Department with recommendations that visas or green cards be revoked, and officials at State testified at trial that they acted on those recommendations.
How did the government defend itself?
Well, government lawyers denied that there is a specific policy. They said that officials have simply been using existing immigration laws to go after people that President Trump believes pose a threat to national security. Trump and his top officials often accuse pro-Palestinian activists of being anti-Semitic and of being supporters of Hamas terrorism. But in his ruling, Judge Young noted the government presented no evidence to back these claims up. So the key question, he wrote, was whether non-citizens legally in the U.S. have the same free speech rights as the rest of us. And here's how he answered that question in writing. Quote, the court answers this constitutional question unequivocally. Yes, they do.
Okay, now what's the reaction been?
Well, in a statement, a DHS spokeswoman called Judge Young, who was appointed by President Reagan, by the way, a, quote, craven judge who is smearing and demonizing ICE law enforcement. A lawyer for the academics celebrated the ruling and said that if the First Amendment means anything, it means the government can't imprison people simply because it disagrees with their political views.
In his ruling, the judge didn't actually tell the government to stop going after these students. So what are the next steps?
Well, Judge Young said that he will soon hold a hearing to help him decide on a remedy aimed at getting the government to comply with the Constitution. But he also noted that he's worried he won't actually be able to get the government to do that because he wrote that when it comes to laws and regulations, quote, President Trump simply ignores it all. Those are his words.
That's NPR's Adrian Florido. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
It happened.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. The slow-moving train wreck we've been watching for a week has indeed wrecked. The government shutdown started at midnight. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers will be furloughed. The Trump administration is threatening to fire others. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates that about 750,000 federal employees could be furloughed during the shutdown. Some federal workers deemed essential, like air traffic controllers and baggage screeners, will work without pay. Federal employees are guaranteed back pay when the government reopens. That's not the case for federal contractors. Stephanie Senek-Castro is president of the Professional Services Council, a contractor trade group. She says they'll keep working, or trying to at least.
One big impact, though, is that they may require actions by employees in the government who are simply not at their desks and not answering emails or phones, or these contractors may require access to government facilities.
Or they may find the employee they're trying to reach has been fired. The Office of Management and Budget issued a memo to federal agency heads telling them to consider firing workers in programs without funding or whose work is, quote, not consistent with the president's priorities. The American Federation of Government Employees has filed a lawsuit saying the threats of mass firings are an unlawful abuse of power and violate the laws on how the government is supposed to function during a shutdown. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all down in the 5-7% range. Dow futures down to 241 points. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.16%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Baird. Employee-owned and independent, Baird offers global financial advice focused solely on clients' needs while consistently reinvesting in the expertise and capabilities to serve those needs. More information at BairdDifference.com. And by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot. Learn more about Snapshot at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot not available in California or from all agents.
The Federal Reserve is walking a tightrope in so many ways right now. It bears two burdens required by law: keep inflation under control and get as many people employed in the economy as possible. And to do that, it has to read the economy at a time when the economy is hard to read. And so much is changing that's making that job even tougher. Tariffs, stubborn inflation, a slowing labor market, now a government shutdown. To get a glimpse of how the Fed is thinking about this, we sat down with Susan M. Collins, president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. We started by talking about the government. We are talking some 12 hours before a government shutdown may happen. What do you do under a government shutdown?
Well, the Federal Reserve system continues regular operations, so it would not impact all of the things that we do. We would continue operating as usual, and that means doing what we can to understand the economy. Certainly, some of the key data that we look at would likely be delayed, and that can create challenges. At the same time, we look at a wide range of data to understand economic conditions and to develop our outlooks.
We have a bunch of new tariffs in place or coming soon on pharmaceuticals, on furniture, on timber. What is your view on whether tariffs are going to meaningfully affect inflation? And if so, when?
There are still uncertainties about exactly where tariffs will land. And it's also the case that while we are seeing some impact of tariffs on goods prices, at the same time, it's not surprising to me that it's taking some time for that to unfold, actually for a few reasons. One is, of course, there were some inventories that firms had. I think the uncertainty about how long tariffs might last, especially in an environment where price levels have already increased because of past inflation, and tariffs, when firms think that they will be more long-lasting, they expect to pass them through further. And the belief that they would be more long-lasting has increased over time. So that's another reason why it's not surprising to me that it's taking some time for the tariffs to show through. But it's hard to know exactly where things will settle because it's still unfolding.
Of course, the other part of your mandate is full employment. The job market is slowing down. Where do you see it going this year?
I would call job growth anemic in many sectors. And at the same time, though, that reflects both a decline in labor demand, but also a decline in labor supply, largely likely reflecting immigration restrictions and perhaps some other factors as well. And so the kind of unusual part to that is we have seen relatively little increase in unemployment. So there's this curious kind of balance. And I don't rule out the possibility that that really anemic labor demand means that we do start to see a more meaningful increase in the unemployment rate.
The inflation that we're looking at today seems different. You know, it could be a one-time hit from tariffs, and it's focused on imported goods. What can Fed interest rates do about that, and why worry about it as much?
So very clear reasons why worry about it. So first of all, as part of our mandate from Congress, we are charged with price stability, by which I mean low and stable inflation. You know, in an environment where no one's thinking about inflation, we still have an environment where everyone's thinking about inflation. And so restoring price stability matters for people and firms. And it also creates an environment, price stability, in which you have economic vibrancy and you can really sustain over time maximum employment.
The FOMC voted to cut rates a couple weeks ago. Do you think we need another one?
We'll have to wait and see where the data is. Again, inflation is still elevated, and the labor market risks have increased a bit with the softening, in particular, the anemic labor demand.
Susan M. Collins, President and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, thank you so much.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here and back again.
You can hear more of our conversation with President Collins at marketplace.org. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, A9.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji welcomes textile artist Kristen Anderson Friday, October 3rd from 5 to 7. Anderson's exhibit is Refugia, the Seasonal Pond Project, with tapestries accompanied by words from local poets. Anderson will give a brief presentation at 5:30. Adventures in Lifelong Learning continues its fall season every Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the Bemidji Eagles Club.
Coffee and treats are served beginning at 9:40. There will be a variety of speakers each week. Find a full schedule on Facebook. Look for Bemidji Adventures in Lifelong Learning.